All right. I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 6:53 p.m. on Monday, March 15th, 2021. Members present are Representatives Kaufman, McCarty, Nelson, Schrage, Snyder, and on the phone we have Co-Chair Fields. Representative Fields, are you on the phone?
I'm on the phone.
All right, excellent. Just checking the audio. Thank you. Representative Fields got snowed in today. He got stuck in Sitka, and Teams isn't working today, so the only way for him to participate was to do it telephonically. So thank you to everybody's indulgence. It meant that I get to chair this lovely committee tonight as well, which wasn't on my agenda. So let the record reflect that we've got a quorum to conduct business. And I want to thank our secretary today, Leah Fraser, and our LAMO moderator, Carson Walters, for joining us this evening. We're holding today's meeting in a combination of in-person and teleconference, as I just referenced. I'll try to make sure that I take breaks periodically to ask Representative Fields if he's got any questions, since he's not in the room and can't raise his hands virtually. Please be sure to announce yourself before speaking. It'll make it easier for also our other testifiers to hear you as well. If you haven't done so already, it's a good time to silence your cell phones. Today, first up, we have an introductory hearing for HB 100, Representative Wohl's bill TVEP reauthorization. Second is an introductory hearing for HB 132, which is a committee bill on apprenticeship programs that Co-Chair Fields will be introducing. And then third is a second hearing for HB 45, Representative Josephson's bill on workers' compensation and contagious diseases. And then lastly, we will forward the appointees we heard on Friday in committee for confirmation for the joint confirmation session. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Any questions, Rep. Fields?
No.
All right. Thanks. That brings us to our first order of business. We're going to take up HB 100. I don't know, those uncomfortable pauses give Rep. Fields the opportunity to talk, but want to make sure he has the opportunity to ask any questions you need to. Come forward, Representative Wohl, and also and Ashley Carrick is his aide working on the bill. And then available today, we also to speak on the bill and answer questions, we have Terry Cothran, who's the Vice President for Workforce Development at the University of Alaska, Louise Dean with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and Patsy Westcott, Director of the Unemployment Division, who oversees the Unemployment Insurance Trust, out of which the TVEP program is funded. So, Representative Wohl, why don't you go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Good evening, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, and thank you for having me before the committee today to hear HB 100, also called the TVEP Reauthorization Bill. TVEP, as you see, is Technical Vocational Education Program. This, as an introduction, HB House Bill 100 would reauthorize the Technical Vocational Education Program, or TVEP, for another 3 years until 2024. This program was established in 2000 to utilize 0.16% of unemployment insurance receipts to provide grants to career and technical education providers across the state. In the past, the program has distributed an average of around $12 million. The TVEP program impacts thousands of students by offering industry-specific training, opportunities that help Alaskans get to work in industries such as fishing, mining, aviation, healthcare, and others. Program recipients include the University of Alaska, the Alaska Vocational Technical Center, also known as AVTEC, the Alaska Technical Center, Ilisavik College on the North Slope, and am I skipping a page? No. And this list has been unchanged since 2014. With that, I will ask my staff, Ashley Carrick, to walk through more details about the program. After that, we'd have Terry Cothran, who administers TVEP allocation for University of Alaska, describe the program. And as we heard from Co-Chair Sponholz, someone from Department of Labor as well, I believe.
Yep.
So, and fortunately, we did have time to go over this in our subcommittee, so some of the newer members that didn't hear this bill last year heard some of it earlier. And with that, Ashley can come up and walk through the bill.
Sounds good. Ms. Carrick, welcome back.
Thank you. For the record, Ashley Carrick, staff for Representative Wohl. And like Representative Wohl said, we did get a chance to talk a little bit about the TVET program from the Department of Labor side of things during the Labor Subcommittee last week. And this is going to be an overview of the program, primarily its impact and what the program actually does for the recipients. And just to start out with a little bit of history of the TVET program, it's established under AS23.15.830, and it was created in 2000, providing non-competitive grant assistance to education entities in Alaska who are delivering specific vocational and technical training across the state. And in 2014, the legislature did increase the amount of funds used for TVET from 0.15% of unemployment insurance receipts up to the current amount of 0.16%. And we'll see in a slide or two how the recipient history has changed over time. But as Representative Wohl mentioned in his introduction, this bill would reauthorize until FY24. Some of the training that TVET recipients offer include industries such as aviation, fisheries, construction, many industries we think of as being technical and vocational training. Other industries, though, include renewable energy, healthcare, information technology, and there are other kinds of vocational training offered by TVET program recipients. This next slide shows a somewhat opaque description of how TVET funding gets distributed. The main takeaway from this chart is just to see that TVEP is allocated from the UI taxable wage base. That's where that 0.16% comes from. And then this is each year is allocated out to the recipients by statute. The percentages listed we'll look at on the next slide. So the TVEP recipients have changed over time. When the program was first introduced in 2000, there were three recipients: the University of Alaska, Kotzebue Training Center, and Alaska Vocational Technical Center. And then, as you can see in the red, in 2001, the Galena Project Education Training Center, which eventually became Galena Interior Learning Academy, was added for a 4% contribution. Then in 2004, we had two more recipients added: Southwest Alaska Vocational Education Center, or SAVEC, and the Ute People's Learning Center. On the next slide, we're showing how the recipient list did grow. In 2008, we actually added four new recipients: the Delta Partners for Progress, Amundsen Educational Center, Northwest Alaska Career and Technical Center, or NACTEC. And then University of Alaska Southeast had its own contribution for a brief period of time. This is partially because the University of Alaska Southeast is actually in the community campus system, and so that was part of why that was broken out separately from the UA allocation. And then current TVEP recipients, these were reauthorized in 2014. This was when Illisogvic College was added for a 5% contribution or allocation, rather. And then this program was reauthorized in 2017 with the same list of 10 recipients. And you can see on the left-hand side of this slide where these recipients are located in the state. So it covers a wide breadth and range of Alaska's regions. And importantly, I'd like to highlight that the University of Alaska offers their programs, and they distribute statewide their 45% allocation. This next slide is the current TVEP distribution list, and there's a couple of notes on this slide. First is that FY21 governor's amended distribution. This is what recipients expected to receive last year when the initial distribution list was put out. And then the red column is the FY21 COVID revised distribution. So this was revised in June of 2020. And it was based on the draw from unemployment. So it impacted the 0.16% allocation, or draw, rather. The blue column on the right was updated in January, on January 11th of 2021, and that reflects a trend upward in the FY21 numbers. And so this is what recipients will ultimately have received for FY21 as long as the supplemental budget passes this year. And so that is contingent upon passage of the supplemental. And then finally, on the far right column is the FY22 distribution proposed for this year. The date is, I make a note that the date is wrong, revised on March 11th of 2021 rather than 2020 there. And this is what recipients should be able to expect for the coming fiscal year, should the program be reauthorized.
All right, we have a question from Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, well, what I'm seeing in my book is different than the slide that was presented. Different years, different numbers. Was there an update that went out?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Kaufman, there was an update to that chart and to our presentation, and we can get that to you.
Thank you.
Do you have a question, Representative McCarty?
Yes, through the chair, at these slides here, do you have numbers of what the unemployment insurance collection was, or we have that number there, of what that represents in numbers of employees in the state?
Through the chair to Representative McCarty, I think that question would be better answered by Louise Dean on the line.
Ms. Dean? Did you hear the question, Ms. Dean?
Yes, I did. And I don't want to pass the buck, but Director Westcott.
I think Patsy Westcott is the person who knows the answer to this question. Yeah.
Right. The unemployment insurance is handled through the Division of Employment and Training Services. And if I could ask Director Westcott to step in and answer this question.
Ms. Westcott?
Can you hear me?
We can hear you now. Thanks.
Okay. So for the record, my name is Patsy Westcott. I'm the director of the Division of Employment and Training Services. Could I have the question repeated, please?
Brett McCarty?
Okay. Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Westcott, the question is, what is the number of employees each year that this calculation is based off of?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, I do not have the number of employees in front of me at this time. We can certainly get back to the committee with that with that specific information. My apologies.
And that's because it's the total number of workers in the state of Alaska. Is the
correct
reason for the question?
That's
Representative
correct.
McCarty?
And the follow-up with that.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Is that 2020, we saw a very significant reduction in workers in Alaska and a lot of people on unemployment. I believe some around 40,000 people. Is that correct? Is that number familiar? And so with that in mind, it seems like the 22 proposal is going to be, or do we know, even have an idea of what the 22 numbers might look like, and when would we know, have a better idea of that?
Yeah, so through the chair, Representative McCarty, you are correct. We did see, we did see a decline in the amount that was collected for TVEP from state fiscal year 20 and what we estimate state fiscal year 21 to be as a result of the pandemic and, of course, the layoffs. And the difference between, I do have an estimate, and the difference is about a 15.2% decline. So what we saw in state fiscal year 20 for TVEP was an allocation of just slightly over $13.1 million. And what we estimate state fiscal year 2021 to be is about $11.1 million. So it's almost a $2 million decline in the revenues collected specifically for TVAP. And that really is a direct result of the impact of the pandemic and the shutdown and the layoffs that we saw. And we also estimate, I will say that for state fiscal year 22, we do see that coming up a little bit. So for state fiscal year 21, we estimate $11.1 million. For state fiscal year 22, we estimate $12.1 million. So there has been a decline, but we do see that starting to trend back up for state fiscal year 2022. But as far as the exact number of employees, that's something that I would have to get back to the committee on.
Okay, thank you.
All right. You want to proceed? Are there any other questions while Ms. Carrick's taking a break? Oh, she's moved on to her question slide, so it's a great time for questions, yeah. Representative Fields, do you have any questions? I'm going to take that as a no. All right. Is there anything else you want to add to the discussion now?
Through the chair, I don't think I have anything else to add to the discussion other than just to say that our office is very much available for questions, and the Department of Labor has worked really closely with us on helping us to understand the numbers for the current distribution as well as last year being a sort of a unique situation. So we're happy to work with folks, and we do have a presentation from Terry Cothran with the university to walk through some of the benefits of the TVET program for them.
Fantastic. Thanks. Let's do that. Actually, I have a question before we move on to Ms. Cothran. My apologies. I'm going to hold it until later. Ms. Cothran, you want to go ahead? Are you on the line?
I am.
All right. Fantastic. Yes. Welcome.
Great. Thank you so much. For the record, my name is Terry Cothran, Associate Vice President of Workforce Development at the University of Alaska. And I want to thank co-chairs Bonholz and Fields and members of the committee for the opportunity to talk with you about this important funding source to the university. I also want to thank Representative Wohl for sponsoring and introducing HB 100. This evening, I'm going to provide an overview of how the university, as one of the TVEP recipients, utilizes this funding source and provide some examples of how TVEP supports key industries in Alaska and the types of graduate outcomes that are produced. Next slide, please. The University of Alaska is Alaska's system for higher education and includes three separately accredited universities that have distinct missions and are also responsible for the community college mission through our 13 community campuses. All combined, it is the most comprehensive workforce provider in the state. Our breadth of programs range from short-term career and technical education certificates all the way through doctorate degrees, and many of these programs are available statewide. Next slide. As a TVEP recipient, UA utilizes its funds as a single allocation within the UA system. The program is administered through a competitive request for proposal or grant process by the UA Workforce Development Committee that includes representatives from each university and the Alaska Workforce Investment Board Executive Director. The funding is distributed as a result of a process that is inclusive of all campuses and programs in the UA system that meets the funding priorities listed here. This process supports collaboration and leveraging resources to increase efficiencies across the university and the state, while also maintaining flexibility to be responsive to industry and regional workforce needs. Next slide. As you can see, the FY20 UA TVEP allocations support high priority industries in our state, from oil and gas and mining, listed on the left here, and reflected in resources and energy, along with fisheries, maritime, and health, to name a few. And the graph on the right shows that funding is distributed across all six economic regions of the state. Next slide, please. These are UA's student outcomes for last year's TVEP funding cycle that resulted in serving over 4,300 students. In the following slides, I'll go through some specific examples of how TVEP supports UA's ability to be responsive to Alaska's high-demand industries. And please note, for every example I give, there are many more that could be shared across UA's programs and campuses. And also note that although TVEP is a critical funding source, it is not the only funding the university invests to address the workforce needs of these industries. Next slide, please. Research and analysis at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development is projecting that while the pandemic has certainly slowed some employment growth in the oil and gas sector, they are estimating that long-term growth is still likely. TVEP investments that help meet this workforce demand and benefit the oil and gas industry are expanded access to fabrication and 3D printing to over 50 engineering students annually for hands-on projects, and access to over 600 K-12 students during the summer for career exploration. We've also leased shop and classroom space at the Fairbanks Pipeline Training Center, providing UAF process tech students the opportunity to work on state-of-the-art equipment, and invested in well-controlled training that helps the industry meet safety requirements to prevent blowouts and promote safe drilling practices. Regarding the graduate employment outcomes, this past year, we partnered with Research and Analysis to develop workforce reports that demonstrate graduate outcomes across 9 key industries. So the graduate employment data in this presentation are from those reports. And you can see here highlights from 3 program areas, all in high demand and important to the oil and gas industry. For example, 90% of the process technology graduates find work within a year of graduating and have impressively high earnings, nearly $74,000 within their first year and more than $130,000 by their fifth year. We also found that 93.5% of working graduates are Alaska residents compared to 70.9% for all oil and gas workers. Next slide.
Ms. Catherine, before you move on to the next slide, can you give us an example of a process tech degree and a process tech career, or maybe a couple in each category?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Swanholz. An example of a process tech degree, it is actually called a process tech degree, and there's occupational endorsements that are short-term all the way to a 2-year associate level degree. Mm-hmm. And many of those graduates work directly in the oil and gas industry, for example, along the pipeline at some of the pump stations.
Okay, just to unpack that a little bit, I've heard the term process tech used. I've heard my mom use it many times because my mom used to work in labor workforce development, but I don't really know what a process tech does. And maybe Representative Kaufman knows what a process tech does, but maybe you could sort of describe what a process tech actually does, because I'm seeing that they do really great in terms of employment and also in terms of compensation. I have a son-in-law who's, you know, looking for future pathways. I'm maybe self-interested, but I think maybe other members of the committee would be curious as well.
Certainly, Chair Swanholz. It might be that Representative Kaufman, I understand, has some background and can provide additional insight, but broadly, imagine a lot of levers and pipes, and it's about moving those through and managing the pressure levels and keeping things flowing. That's a very rudimentary explanation.
So there's probably a lot of process tech professionals working on the pipeline.
Correct.
You want to elaborate, Representative Kaufman?
Thank you. How much do you want to know?
The executive summary in 3 sentences or less.
To the chair to all who are interested, it's all the things that one has to do to maintain control of the process. There, in a typical process, there's everything from pressure, flow rates, temperature, and if one is helping to control that. You're engaging in manipulating the various control devices. Many of them now are automated, so you're dealing with that too, of keeping the process up and running. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any other questions on this topic? All right, Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair. Can you differentiate what you mean by degree and certification?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, certification, so an occupational endorsement certification is you often a year or less, and a degree is the next level up of a certificate or associate's degree.
Follow up? Mm-hmm.
So are you referring to, you said associate's degree, but are you also referring to a bachelor's degree or higher?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, correct. So it's an occupational endorsement certificate, or OEC, would be the first step in any of our degree pathways. The next would be a certificate, and then we go to an associate degree, then a bachelor's degree, and on to our graduate program.
Follow?
And a follow-up with that, do you have a percentage of where the students are ending their training? You know, are they, how many are, or what percentage is a bachelor's degree, how much are associate degree, how many are, you know, something like that?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, that is certainly information we can get for you.
Thank you.
The university absolutely tracks all of that information copiously, I'm sure. All right, thank you. Go ahead. Ms. Catherine.
Thank you, Chair Swanholz. So on the health slide, research and analysis of Department of Labor is projecting that the healthcare sector, an already large industry, to grow at twice the rate of the economy overall by 2028. To help meet the needs in healthcare, TVEP investments have contributed to upgrades in technology that are shared across health programs, program development or expansion in both urban and rural communities, including extended access to nursing programs through distance delivery, an expansion of hands-on experience through community and practicum placement of our health science students that enhances the student's educational experience, connects them with industry partners for employment opportunities, and increases their competitiveness for graduate programs in high-demand healthcare careers, such as pharmacy and physician assistants. The graduate employment outcomes highlight three program areas that are important to the healthcare industry. CNA can be completed in 6 weeks, providing a short path to employment. And this also provides them a pathway to continue towards a nursing degree that could increase the earning potential from $33,000 to over $50,000, or nearly $70,000 with 5 years of experience. Out of the 31 clinical health programs listed in the Health Workforce Report, more than 82% are working in Alaska within a year of graduating. Next slide, please. For the aviation sector, while research and analysis is projecting a slight decline of less than 2% in jobs, there will continue to be vacancies within the 6,000 plus jobs needed by 2028. And TVEP investments benefiting the aviation industry include equipment and technology upgrades, along with the development of distance delivered aviation maintenance instruction to provide students access in remote locations around Alaska to foundational knowledge required to become certified as a Federal Aviation Administration mechanic. And the aviation graduate employment outcomes show strong wage growth, a jump of nearly 40% by year five for aviation maintenance graduates, and 53% wage growth for those in administration. As it takes time for pilots to earn their different ratings, we would anticipate to see larger wage growth over time. For example, commercial pilots with experience have an earning potential of $89,000 and beyond as they gain more experience. Next slide, please. I mentioned equipment upgrades. Here are some examples of aviation investments
The top left is a professional piloting student practicing instrument flying in one of the two Redbird simulators that TVEP helped fund at UA's Aviation Technology Center. On the right, a student and instructor are approaching Merrill Field to land in one of the TVEP-funded aircraft in UAA's professional piloting program. And on the bottom, TVEP also helped upgrade the air traffic control technology that provides students cutting-edge experience to prepare them for the rigorous four-month-long certification test at the Federal Aviation Administration's facility in Oklahoma City. Next slide, please. For the mining industry, research and analysis at the Department of Labor is projecting the industry to grow by 28% by 2028. To help meet the workforce needs in mining, TVEP investments have contributed to the delivery of hard skills mine training camps at the only all-encompassing underground and surface mine training camp in the world through UAS Mining and Petroleum Training Service. And TVEP has also supported several upgrades to equipment. The graduate employment outcomes highlight three program areas important to the mining industry, from mine operators to geological sciences. And similar to the oil and gas industry, the graduate outcomes for the 44 programs evaluated in mining showed an average of 92.7% of working graduates are Alaska residents, compared to 65.3% for all mining workers. The data clearly shows that hiring our graduates significantly boosts the Alaska residency rate within the mining industry. On average, fifth-year wages are higher than the average Alaska wage of nearly $60,000. And looking at the wage outcomes from all 44 programs in the mining report, on average, the wages exceed $104,000 by their fifth year of employment. Next slide, please. According to research and analysis, by 2028, fisheries is expected to grow by 8%, seafood by 37.2%, and the maritime industry is projected to have a slight decrease of 1%. To help meet their workforce needs, TVEP investments have contributed to partnering with industry to train seafood processors for direct employment, maritime program development and expansion that align to industry standards, and upgraded Ketchikan campus's maritime bridge simulator to a state-of-the-art full mission simulator. These are some of the graduate employment outcomes from three fisheries program areas. Overall, in the past 10 years, the fisheries programs have produced 975 graduates for jobs in fisheries, marine biology, oceanography, and natural resource management. And on average, 94.1% of the working graduates are Alaska residents, compared to 66.3% for all workers in fisheries and marine sciences. Next slide. And here's a picture of the new full mission simulator in the UAS Ketchikan Maritime Training Center. This was a Facebook post by a current student who just completed her U.S. Coast Guard approved class, pointing out the capabilities in her post of the new simulator being able to provide a variety of hands-on experiences. Next slide, please. TVEP investments to support the workforce needs of the IT industry include computer lab upgrades to provide virtual or remote access to increase students' hands-on experience, and revamped curriculum to meet industry needs and enhance employment in high-demand IT occupations.
I just want to take
the investments in
Ms. Catherine. We're just going to take a quick pause here. We're having trouble getting the images in the presentation. The computer is saying that there's not enough something to display the image. An error in reading the images so that we can't see them. Does everybody have the slides in their books so they can see them for themselves? All right. So everybody has the presentation and can see the images in our own paper copies of the presentation, but they're not projecting well. So
thank you, Chair Swanholt. I was worried that there was just a delay in
feed on the video.
No, there is a little bit of a delay in the feed as well, but it's certainly we're having a little bit of a technical problem, and Ms. Carrick is trying to be creative right now and see if she can't find another way to pull it up. All right, mission success. Well done, Ms. Carrick. All right, my apologies, Ms. Catherine. Let's proceed now.
Thank you, Chair Sponholz. So on slide 13, on information technology, TVEP investments to support the workforce needs of the IT industry include computer lab upgrades to provide virtual or remote access to increase students' hands-on experience, and revamp curriculum to meet industry needs and enhance employment in high-demand IT occupations. TVEP investments in IT programs contributed to the outcomes highlighted here. For example, more than 80% of computer and networking technology graduates work in Alaska 1 year following graduation. And because IT occupations support many industries across the state, it was interesting to find that 44% of the graduates are working in the public administration sector. Next slide, please. Here is a success student success story from one of our construction programs. I apologize. I jumped forward in my own slides. Slide 14.
We're looking at an IT student success. Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. Here is a great student success story of Stephanie Harvey, who didn't follow a traditional educational path. As an early in life mother, she had to take a break from education and returned when her children became a bit older. And when she returned, she discovered her love for computer networking. Fast forward, she is now an alum of the UAF Community and Technical College IT Specialist Program and one of their networking instructors, who recently received industry recognition for her work by Cisco. Hmm. Next slide, please. According to the research and analysis at Department of Labor, the construction industry is projected to grow by 10.7% by 2028. To help meet the construction industry's workforce needs, TVEP investments have contributed to updating the apprenticeship technology degree through UAA's Community and Technical College to be more accessible through online delivery. You'll also hear more about this during testimony for House Bill 132. Like other programs mentioned this evening, TVEP has also supported upgrades and equipment and helped fund hands-on training through the UAS Construction Program, who partners with the Juneau Housing Trust and the Juneau School District to design and construct homes for low-income families in the Juneau area. The graduate and employment outcomes highlights from the construction report include those listed here. And also, over the past 10 years, nearly 2,000 graduates have been trained in programs leading to employment in carpentry, heavy truck and equipment driving, construction management, welding, civil engineering, and surveying. And their average wages are $70,000 within 5 years of graduation. Next slide, please. Here's a student success story from one of our construction programs. Jessica Center graduated from the UAA Construction Management Program in 2020 and already started her job as an assistant project manager the semester prior to graduation. And next slide. In conclusion, the University of Alaska strongly supports the reauthorization of TVEP to provide a stable funding source to address Alaska's workforce needs. And specific to the times we are in, TVEP is critical in helping support our economic recovery. As you've seen by these examples, it funds short-term career and technical education programs that serve the workforce needs of Alaska's key industries and will help reskill and upskill Alaskans who have been displaced by the pandemic. By reauthorizing TVEP for at least 3 years, it will provide some of the stability needed to train Alaskans for jobs in Alaska and get them back to work as quickly as possible. And last slide. Thank you again for this opportunity.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Ms. Catherine? Representative Catherine.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm curious about the process for apportioning the training. Is it by market demand or some forecast? How do the decisions get made around which training to provide? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, part of it is looking at labor market information, like some of the data I just went through, and looking at the workforce demand analysis that our Department of Labor provides. And then other part is having that local and regional conversations and partnerships with industry to ensure we're meeting their workforce needs.
All right. Are there any other questions? Representative Fields, do you have any questions?
No, I don't.
All right, thanks. I've got a couple. You know, one of the things that I noted in the slides earlier was that the percentage of TBEP funds that have gone to the university has gone down from a peak of 63% in 2001 to about 45% now. How has that impacted the university's, you know, allocation of TVET funds and what you've been able to do with them?
Chair Sponholz, simply speaking, with funding, we can train more students. And we certainly have made use of the dollars as most efficiently as we can. And as it's declined through the years, continue to try to find as many efficiencies to preserve the programs directly to serve those as many of the students as we can. More funding certainly helps. And I will say the other TVET recipients, many of them are we partner with, and it's important to provide that career and technical education funding throughout the state to have access to career and technical education training for as many students as possible.
Thank you. I think, you know, one thing that's also really helpful for the committee to know is that these TVET funds also leverage a lot of other funds that the university is able to attract. The university in each of these program areas that were highlighted today, you know, raise hundreds of thousands or many millions of dollars every year in private sector investment directly into these programs, because the private sector also recognizes the value of these programs, and so we're able to sort of leverage private sector investment with the TVET funds to do really great workforce development. And I noticed, like, for example, that one of the largest allocations within the University of Alaska's use of TVET funds is for health careers, and health careers has been one of the high demand growth fields in the state of Alaska for a very long time, but the health sector have also been very large investors in health education. And so our hospitals, for example, have invested in nursing education, and that's been able to leverage the TVET funds, and it all comes together to make sure that we've got all of the nurses and physicians assistants and dental hygienists that we need to make sure that we're all healthy into the future. I have a question for you, Ms. Cawthron, about the information technology section. That's the smallest allocation right now, and I think it's a fairly new addition in the TVEP in TVEP allocation within the university, and I'm wondering, you know, if you can talk a little bit about how long you've been doing that and where it might go in the future.
Thank you, Chair Sponholz. IT is one of the high demand areas that we want to support, and we've been supporting it through TVET funding throughout the years. As you noted, it's a smaller allocation, not necessarily by total design. We do have our internal competitive process and are dependent on those proposals being submitted internally. And like I said at the beginning, if it's not, you know, TVEP is one source of funding, other university funds are being directed towards these workforce programs, and it just might be that IT is utilizing other sources and partnering with industry differently to address those needs.
At UAA, I can't speak for the other campuses, the computer science field is still, program is still fairly small when compared to a lot of other programs, but, you know, knowing the way that things are moving over time, you could imagine that there might be some job growth in that area eventually, since information technology has made our world smaller and Alaska continues to diversify our economy, and it seems like an opportunity for us moving forward. Representative Shragi, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do, actually. I was just curious to what extent these programs are accessible off campus. I mean, are any of these programs, like the IT information technology program, accessible from the Bristol Bay campus or any of these others, or do they all require an in-person presence?
Through the chair, there many of our programs are accessible online, even more so now to, thanks to the pandemic and so much going online. And there's other programs, even some of our career and technical education programs that have been historically much more hands-on, have found creative ways to deliver online. For example, back to our process tech program, the Kenai Peninsula College through UAA used to have two locations of delivery, one in Anchorage and one in Kenai, and they found some efficiencies by moving the program and having many of the classes available online. They're able to deliver that from Kenai effectively and serve more students, provide more students access to that program, and then they provide creative and flexible lab schedules for students to come obtain their hands-on experience in Kenai.
That's wonderful to hear. Thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions for Ms. Cothran? All right. Seeing none, any other questions for Ms. Westcott or Ms. Dean with the Department of Labor?
So,
Representative McCarty?
Yes, through the chair, is this going to be addressed on the performance measures or the TVAC report that we were given?
You want to ask a question about it?
I do. I do have a question. And I do not know. I believe it's page 6 then. Yes, page 6 in the report. Mm-hmm. I've seen this before, and I need some clarity to understand it. So on the performance measures, who am I talking with?
You're probably going to
just bring up the question and
which
then go
question?
From there. Okay, so it has a grid on the different institutions and percent of employees and the outcomes after the training there, and it shows a median of what a person in those programs get in wages. So the last two columns, can someone explain to me what that means, and then I have a follow-up.
In the TVEP report, was that a question for maybe for Ms. Bean? Yeah, and I don't have that in front of me, so. Ms. Dean, are you familiar with the report that he's discussing, referencing? It's the 2020 TVET program report. Is that your lane?
Through the chair, it is partly in my lane. the TVET recipient provide this information to the department and to research and analysis so the report can be prepared. So there's a measurement after, you know, 1 to 12 months after exit, 7 to 12 months after exit, and 1 to 12 months after exit. I'm sorry, I have a small copy of the text. So each TVEP recipient provides this information to the Department of Labor. So the percentages show the number of participants who exited are employed 1 year after exit. And then the percentages change because the time changes, like 6 months, 7 months, and then a year. So it's a little confusing, and this is one of the one of the issues that we've been dealing with. In fact, I believe there was a question similar to this last week. Mm-hmm. And so the way this is reported is a little confusing, but the information does come from the training provider. They provide that information to research and analysis.
There is also an interesting, just as I'm looking at it also, we're sort of comparing a little bit apples and oranges, because some of these programs are pre-college, are not college, they're high school programs, and others are post-secondary. So that accounts for some of the difference in terms of the employment numbers. Do you have another question, Representative McCarty?
I do. I have
a couple
follow-ups to that piece. Mm-hmm. There, one is like what you just said, is that to be able to differentiate a high school student in employment compared to someone else, because I mm-hmm. saw some large numbers from the UA.
Right.
And so that would be helpful to know if there's any ability to differentiate these are certified students, certification students, from a degree student, from a AA student.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, as I was looking at this, is which institutions would I want to go to get the most amount of money once I graduate? And I see some institutions, like Partners for Progress, is $80,000 on the average, and that's an average. And UA would be about $30,000 or so on. So I'm wondering what that's about. You know, certainly, I'm wondering what it's about. Thank you.
You got the.
Through the chair, I can do some research and get that information for you and provide it to you.
So just a clarification as well, this money doesn't go to the students, it goes to the institutions, and I think the number that you're referencing, Representative McCarty, is a per pupil number. So it's the amount of funds that go to that program and divided by the number of students in that program. So in that specific program that you referenced, there's a smaller number of students, and so the per pupil investment from TVEP is much higher. Is that make sense?
It does. And if I could follow up with that
discussion,
there is looking at the formula of what institutions gets what percent of the TVEP money. That if one institution seems to be doing pretty good in performing, would they need more TVEP money, and would we rearrange the percentages?
And that is why we're here, Mr. McCarty.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Is there another question? Ashley Carrick, you want to answer?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative McCarty, if I could just follow up on that discussion as well. Just for example, when you look at Galena Interior Learning Academy, the median wage after exit, it's as the chair was describing partially in terms of this program serves a lot of high school students compared to the university or, say, Illisauga College, which is geared more towards adults in the community. And then another factor is that these numbers obviously have weight and merit, but in addition, they're somewhat correlational in the sense that these programs also, TVEP makes up different proportions of their total ability to provide education. So for the University of Alaska, for example, TVEP provides a different proportion of funding for different programs and different parts of the state. And the same is true for some of these other institutions. For some of the smaller ones, TVEP funding makes up a very large portion of the funds they receive overall for technical education. For others, it makes up a smaller percentage.
Mm-hmm.
You follow?
Last follow-up. I mean, it would be helpful to see the differentiation of where the students are coming from and what you're stating there. Because in my mind, looking at this, I'm thinking, okay, it looks like there needs to be a realignment of the percentages institutions are seem to be performing just on these numbers here, but these numbers are elusive.
All right. Thank you. Representative Shragi.
Well, and I just one thing that may be causing some of the disparity in wages for those that graduate these programs is I imagine some of these programs are more specialized than others, and I think like the UA program offers a wide range of degree programs, not necessarily some of these may offer just programs that are that typically have a very high wage after exiting that program, and so we might see some disparity in outcomes through that. Just offering perspective there.
Representative Wool, do you have something to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess in discussing the median wage after a certain period, I think the as the representative from the Department of Labor mentioned, the Partners for Progress in Delta seems to be the anomaly that's much higher than the rest. Granted, some are low, but there's a lot in the 25 to 35 range or 40, and that one's 80,000. So I just wanted to clarify exactly what that school was doing, and I was asking Ms. Carrick, and I'm not sure that she had the answer for the question that I asked, but I think we will dig a little deeper and find out exactly what kind of graduates they're producing. It might be highly specialized.
All right. Excellent. I think you had some really great questions there. It's a very interesting program. It's a very important program in that it helps, as you heard, you know, produce, you know, ensure that Alaskans are getting hired into many of these high demand, high compensation careers. We need people to be doing a lot of this work. We also want to make sure that we're making good use of resources. And as we saw that, you know, the amount of funds that's available for TVREP right now is lower because our unemployment has been higher in the last, you know, 12 months or so. And so that's going to create sort of additional pressure moving forward. I think it also underscores the importance of the program, though, because we're going to see people that potentially are going to be looking to make a shift in their career path, which often happens when your career gets disrupted. You kind of revisit, am I doing the right thing? Should I be doing something different? Maybe that food service career wasn't looking so good after all. Maybe I want to become a nurse, for example. With that, thank you very much for introducing the bill today, for bringing this issue forward. There's a lot of interest in the topic. As you can tell, we're going to take it up again, I think, later this week. Thank you also to Ms. Dean and Ms. Westcott and Ms. Catherine for joining us today and for your testimony. It was very helpful, and I appreciate it. All right. With that, we're going to go up to House Bill 132. It's a labor and commerce bill on apprenticeships. And introducing the bill for us today are co-chair Fields, who's going to be on the telephone, and his aide and labor and commerce aide, Grace Kubitz. Also available online for questions, if anybody needs them, we have a couple of lifelines here. They are Ann Velardi, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, and you can correct me later.
Velardi.
Thank you. From Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and Genevieve, I can't pronounce your last name. Genevieve, my apologies. With the Department of Revenue, my apologies. All right. Co-Chair Field, do you want to go ahead and put yourself on record and introduce the bill?
Sure. Zach Field, House District 20. Thanks, Co-Chair Sponholz, and thanks to my coworker, Grace Kubitz. We're here to present House Bill 132, a committee bill called the Apprenticeship Expansion Act. And the origins of this bill are rooted, of course, in the longstanding success of Alaska apprenticeships and some experiences I had working in the Department of Labor, including with Ms. Velardi on expanding apprenticeship, but also on conversations with Representative McCarty that we had before Representative McCarty was in the legislature. So when Representative McCarty got elected, I thought it was a good opportunity to look at ideas that we could use to promote apprenticeship. I think some members of this committee will recall that last session, the legislature was able to come together around apprenticeships on a bill called House Bill 308, where we strengthened apprenticeship in the plumbing, pipe fitting, and electrical trades. And this bill before us today is about expanding apprenticeship beyond some of the building trades. Many Alaskans, when they hear apprenticeship, think about our traditional construction trades. But the reality is, in the United States and around the world, there's been tremendous expansion of apprenticeship beyond the traditional building trades, especially in the last decade. We've seen expansion in insurance, financial services, advanced manufacturing, and certainly in Alaska in fields like healthcare. So the bill before us today would support expansion of apprenticeships in terms of sectoral expansion and expansion within traditional sectors, but it also aims to strengthen connections between our career and technical education programs at school districts and apprenticeship programs so that more graduating seniors have career options with post-secondary credentials and more employers have an identified pipeline of skilled talent. Finally, we need to keep working to expand dual credit programs in which apprenticeship program participants earn college credit, and for non-apprenticeship career and technical education program, high school students have more dual credit opportunities. These opportunities are particularly important for socioeconomic mobility, in other words, for graduating seniors who can't afford not to work. For too long, we forced people to make what is an unfair choice, going to work or getting a degree. And with the marriage of college and apprenticeship and career and technical education and college credit, our students can have both. So before summarizing the bill with this PowerPoint, I do want to thank some stakeholders. Number one, I know that Representative McCarty talked to a bunch of stakeholders and wrote up House Bill 108, which currently is contained in House Bill 132. Whether we want to keep these as essentially a comprehensive package or whether Representative McCarty wants to pursue House Bill 108 separately is certainly something I defer to him on, but I definitely want to thank him for doing a lot of research and talking to a lot of people and thinking through how we can support career and technical education. In addition, I want to thank Joni Simpson, Trish Zug, Missy Fraze, Karen Smolin from Fairbanks, Matthew, Anchorage, and Juneau School District, employers such as the Primary Care Association, the U.S. Department of Labor Office of Apprenticeship Director for Alaska, John Hakala, Department of Education and Early Development, Commissioner Johnson, who I know was on the line earlier but had to jump off, unfortunately, before he was able to offer testimony. State Department of Labor staff, University of Alaska staff from multiple campuses, as well as Alaska Pacific University leadership. APU has recently established new college programs aligned with apprenticeship. So turning to the PowerPoint, and I think Ms. Kubitz can advance the slides. If we could just go to the slide number two, I would appreciate it, apprenticeship and CTE background. So Alaska has high-performing apprenticeship programs in the traditional trades. Almost 800 employers participate in apprenticeship today, and there's been some exciting innovation with apprenticeship in new industries. We heard about that in an earlier informational hearing from the Primary Care Association and some others. We also have some outstanding school district programs, but they aren't at the scale that we need to meet student demand. So I think a question I've been asking myself is, what can we do as a state to support these school districts that are doing great work but have an opportunity to scale up? Other states and other nations have shown the potential to expand scale of apprenticeship in CTE. Nations like Switzerland and Germany, states like South Carolina, and we can learn from some of those examples. And the apprenticeship tax credit that's in the bill is an example of trying to learn from successful models. As I mentioned, expansion of apprenticeship and career and technical education helps people pull themselves up by their bootstraps when they can't afford not to work in college. Finally, I think it's worth noting we are going to see new infusions of federal grant support for apprenticeship. And if we as the state legislature help put the right policy framework into place, then we will be better able to capitalize on that federal aid. Grace, if you don't mind going to slide three. So one major component of this bill is it establishes $1,000 per apprentice employer tax credit. Very simple. South Carolina used this to significantly scale up apprenticeship in the area of advanced manufacturing. The bill as currently written is a tax credit for for-profit companies. I think one question we could ask ourselves is, do we want to make this a refundable credit so it also benefits nonprofit employers? Moving on to slide number four. You know, historically, apprenticeship in Alaska has been supported by the good people at the Department of Labor, like Ms. Velarde. I think a question is, can we broaden that support with collaboration from the Department of Education and Early Development? And the language that you see in the bill does envision strong collaboration between labor and education and early development, given the need to expand school to apprenticeship programs and, to the extent possible, align more dual credit opportunities for CTE programs, including in the STEM fields. I think it's important to know that language is fairly general, giving the department the flexibility to support school districts where we can. Moving on to the next slide, college credit and CTE for apprenticeship, the bill does direct the regents to find ways to expand dual credit for CTE courses and college credit for participants in apprenticeship. The university has made some really positive steps in this direction already, including with innovative apprenticeships like the Continental Auto Group apprenticeship that Mr. Libby with the university can speak to in greater detail. As I mentioned, this bill also contains the entirety of House Bill 108 written by Representative McCarty. So I think, you know, in terms of substance, it's actually fairly simple. A tax credit, collaboration among departments, dual credit for the university. So that's a summary of the bill, and I hope that the invited testifiers who, assuming they've been able to hang out online, that we have time to go to them. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Are there any questions for Representative Fields? All right. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Representative Fields, you were talking a little bit earlier at the beginning of your statement about last year, the state legislature helped expand apprenticeship with through the building trade. Was that correct, or I just wanted to know some more context on this.
Yes, what the legislature did was take what had been regulations around apprenticeships in the plumbing, pipe fitting, and electrical trades and put some of those into statute. Those strengthened our statutory support for some of our skilled building trade apprenticeships.
Follow on.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, does that also include a tax credit?
No.
It did not. That's more in terms of occupational licensing.
Okay. Follow on. Mm-hmm. Is there a specific reason as to why this one had a tax credit for $1,000 per student?
My legislation proposes a $1,000 tax credit based on the successful model we've seen in South Carolina scaling up apprenticeship.
Thank
to my knowledge, the legislature has not contemplated an incentive like this before, so I wanted to put it on the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Fantastic. Any other questions for Representative Fields?
Are there going to be people? I'm sorry.
There's more people who are going to testify.
That's
so, right. Yep. All right. Sounds like we're going to go on, and I think our next testifier is going to be John Hakala.
Yes. Yeah, good evening, everyone. My name is John Hakala. I'm the State Director for the Office of Apprenticeship in Alaska, the U.S. Department of Labor. And on February 24th, I delivered a presentation on youth apprenticeship, mm-hmm. and so this is a follow-up to that. I got to I was reviewing the draft language to the act relating to technical education and apprenticeship. I was looking at the version I think February 9th of 2021, and there's two areas when I was reading through and digesting it, right, and letting it set, thinking about it. There are two areas where I'd like to recommend maybe changes to the wording or clarification. And the first one is in section one, and in the parentheses, the number 12. And it says in the draft, provide educational opportunities in the area of vocational education and training and basic education to individuals over 16 years of age who are no longer attending school, semicolon, the department may consult with business and labor unions to develop a program to prepare students for apprenticeships or internships that will lead to employment opportunities. So within that paragraph or section, what I'd like to recommend is that a reference to career and technical education be added. Representative Fields has talked about CTE and in youth apprenticeship, we do look at career and technical education credit for the on-the-job learning and the related technical instruction. There's an Alaska career and technical education plan, so I think it would just be nice to have that reference in there. The second is in that paragraph, there's a reference to internships that will introduce confusion into the intent of the House bill. And my recommendation is to replace the wording for internships with pre-apprenticeships. And the reason being is that internships, work-based learning, on-the-job training, the CTE high school programs, preparatory training, all fall under pre-apprenticeships for purposes of the House bill. Also, the current federal apprenticeship regulations and the draft National Apprenticeship Act for 2021 only reference registered apprenticeship, youth apprenticeship, and pre-apprenticeship. And so that's a couple of recommendations to there. And as far as the reference to career and technical education, I was thinking just add it after the comma in vocational education and training, then add career and technical education, and then go on with your sentence. And then on the last line or so, it says, and to develop a program to prepare students for apprenticeships or pre-apprenticeships that will lead to employment opportunities. So those are the two wording changes to that Section 12. And I just have a short area for Section 3. It says Alaska Statute 43.20 is amended by adding a new section to read. The draft language currently reads, to qualify as a registered apprentice for purposes of credit under this section, a person must participate in a registered apprenticeship program recognized by the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And my discussion about this is that my office is the U.S. Department of Labor Office of Apprenticeship. It's the registration agency for apprenticeship in Alaska. It's always been, and unless the state decided to become a state apprenticeship agency. So with that reasoning, the registration agency should be included in this section to avoid confusion about the roles and responsibility of the state and federal apprenticeship partnership. And the revised wording needs to reflect how our current state-federal apprenticeship partnership currently functions. So basically, in that section, it says to qualify as a registered apprenticeship. It says a person must participate in a registered apprenticeship program, and this would be the suggested wording, registered with the U.S. Department of Labor, Office of Apprenticeship, comma, and recognized by the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And that wording really does reflect our years of partnership with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And so those are my three recommendations to the wording, and I'll welcome any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hackle. I think that's very helpful. Maybe you can send in your specific language so we can make sure that we get that right. I think one of the reasons that we wanted to introduce this bill was that we wanted to make sure that we were setting up the infrastructure to allow us to take advantage of the federal changes in apprenticeship that we're expecting to come down the pike, and your expertise in this is very appreciated. All right, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Hakala, I'm curious, you mentioned a couple of terms, and so the difference between apprenticeship, pre-apprenticeship, and I think you mentioned internship in your comment. So what's the functional difference in those definitions?
Through the chair to Representative Kaufman, the registered apprenticeship is the outcome that a lot of the preparatory programs are hoping for or training towards, and depending on their design, they might have a very tight connection to training their participants to have an advanced standing or direct entry into an apprenticeship where others may not. And so there's work-based learning, internships, the on-the-job training, the preparatory training. They're a component of registered apprenticeship, but registered apprenticeship is more broad and structured, and so they you could say, for example, that they're components of the apprenticeship, but they're not apprenticeship themselves, where registered apprenticeship contains probably all of the components of any one of those work-based learning models, I will call them, whereas the reverse is not true. So this act is specifically about registered apprenticeship. And so when you look at career and technical education, all the preparatory training, pre-apprenticeships, et cetera, they're not a full apprenticeship program. So I hope that answers your question, sir.
To answer your question? Follow up?
Is there a place where I can see that definition?
I would be happy to provide just definitions of these and what they are. So, I would forward that to Representative Fields to share with the committee.
Thank you.
All right, fantastic. Other questions? I can tell you that I had several internships in college and in high school, and they didn't have very specific concrete benchmarks that I had to achieve. Whereas an apprenticeship, there are very specific things you have to learn in order to move on to the next level. So much broader, I think. Internships are more general, and an apprenticeship is much more specific, I think. All right. Next up, we're going to go to Chad Hutchinson. Is Chad Hutchinson on the line? Nope. All right. We're going to go up to then next. We're going to go to Brad Austin with the Plumbers and Pipefitters Union.
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great. My name is Brad Austin, and I'm with the Plumbers and Pipefitters Local 262 here in Juneau, and I'm the training coordinator and instructor. And I was asked to talk about school to apprenticeship programs. We have a school to apprenticeship program with Juneau Douglas High School here. It's a little outdated, and I need to revitalize it. We called out specific classes for the high school students to take, and of course classes change over time, but basically the way the school to apprenticeship program works is we'll have requirements for the high school students, you know, certain classes to take during their time in high school. Our program was set up that at 17 we could actually place them with a contractor. They probably wouldn't be working, you know, with heavy tools or anything, but it gave them a chance to be around the trade and work with some of the plumbers. And then they would be able to do a direct entry into our apprenticeship program once they graduated from high school. They'd have to wait until they graduated because one of our apprenticeship requirements is that you have to have a high school diploma or GED. So at that point, they could do what I said with a direct entry. And that term, if you've never heard that, is really a big deal for somebody trying to get into an apprenticeship program. The normal course to enter an apprenticeship program is to file an application with the training committee. In our case, that only happens once a year. And then sit for an interview and with the local 262 Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee, you're interviewing with six people. So it's a pretty intimidating time for a lot of people. And then you're competing with however many people are coming in through that application process. So the school to apprenticeship candidate that is offered a direct entry into the program bypasses all of that and comes directly into the program. Then in our school to apprenticeship agreement, we also offered credit hours towards the apprenticeship program. So if you're an apprentice in our program or Anchorage's program or Fairbanks, you're going to serve 10,000 hours, 5 years in your apprenticeship program. And our school to apprenticeship agreement offered up to 500 hours of credit. And to put that into other terms, monetary terms, that's halfway to the first raise, which in our program is, yeah, that would be $2. So 3 months into a six-month pay increase. So it's quite an incentive. The partners in the school to apprenticeship programs are, of course, the school and the sponsoring agency, which was which is us in the case of our school to apprenticeship program, and then we would have a meeting with the student, and the way mine's written, it's a student and the parent or guardian, so everybody knows what they're up against. They're no cost to the student, no cost to the school. It's really a win-win situation. And I lost my train of thought there for a minute. Anyway, I think House Bill 132 is going to really help with a couple problems that we encountered. I think it's going to promote and incentivize, you know, the vocational education CTE classes, and it may get us off of that top dusty shelf in the counselor's office and, you know, out front a little bit more. These are great careers for people that choose not to go to college. In our program, a fifth-year apprentice, well, after you've served your 5 years, that apprentice will have made $281,000 in wages. And if you add the benefit package on there, in that 5 years, as an apprentice, that amount comes up to $524,000. So these are really good, high-paying jobs. And the school to apprenticeship program is a great conduit for a easy entry into one of them. The school to apprenticeship program at Local 367 up in Fairbanks, and I believe Rodney Walcott is still on, the training coordinator from there.
Yep, we've got him on as well.
Okay. He shared with me that currently they have 14 school to apprenticeship candidates in their program, and school to apprenticeship was signed with the Fairbanks North Star Borough, so they have 6 schools that they get to work with. You know, and if there's any other questions, he'd be much better to answer them than I would about their program.
All right. Thank you very much. And if you ever have the opportunity to go out and visit the local plumbers and pipefitters training school here in Juneau, it's certainly worth it. I got to do some welding when we went out, which was very cool. All right. Representative McCarty.
Through the chair, Red Austin, thank you very much for presenting, and thank you for the tour last week at the facility. And now I'm really annoyed because you didn't let me weld. Next time, huh?
Next time, yes.
So how many apprenticeship opportunities exist, and what's the percentage of students that you're hearing at Juneau High School, as example? And what do you know of other programs in Juneau? I think you said there are 6 others.
So what we were talking about, the other programs, I was discussing the fact that union apprenticeships for plumbers and pipe fitters, we have 3 in the state of Alaska. But for independent contractors, I knew of 3 independent plumbing apprenticeships here in Juneau alone. And I think I was kind of making a point that there's probably a lot more independent contractor apprenticeship programs than union ones in numbers. And Mr. Hockla could speak to that with probably very exact numbers.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet.
That answer your question? All right, excellent. I'm noting the time. So the clock was an hour wrong, and I lost track of time a little bit, and I didn't keep us keep our ship running as tight as it should have been earlier. So I apologize for that. I'm going to try to move us along here while still making sure we have the opportunity for all of our testifiers who are online. Thank you very much for your time today, Mr. Austin. Next up, we've got Rodney Walcott, who's with the Plumbers and Pipefitters in Fairbanks.
Yes, can you hear me?
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rodney Walcott. I'm the training director for the United Association of Plumbers and Pipefitters, Local 375 in Fairbanks. Thank you for the opportunity. I was, through the chair, I was more here just to answer questions. So if there is individual questions, I would love to try to shed some light on them.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Walcott? All right. Looks like you're off the hook for right now. Maybe hang on in case something comes up.
Okay.
Thanks for making yourself available. We appreciate it. All right. Next up, we're going to go to Mari Sell with the Alaska Primary Care Association.
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Sponholz. My name is Mari Sell. I'm the Workforce Development Director for the Alaska Primary Care Association and the South Central AHEC. I'm testifying to express support for this bill and also to provide you with some feedback. I really do believe this bill has the potential to open doors for youth to enter health and human services careers. And as way of background, I'm with the Alaska Primary Care Association. We're a nonprofit that supports federally qualified health centers, also known as community health centers. Our mission is to create healthy communities by supporting our community health centers. And one of the ways we do that is by supporting workforce development activities. And you might know that many of our clinics and health facilities are located in quite remote frontier communities in our state. And we're a multi-agency sponsor for registered apprenticeships, and we have been since 2017. I just want to recognize the Alaska Department of Labor. I know Ann Velarde is on the line, I think, still in her office. They've really helped grow healthcare apprenticeships in our state through the American Apprenticeship Initiative and the state expansion grant. And we have been able to work alongside that office to grow apprenticeships. What being a multi-agency sponsor means is that we work with a variety of healthcare employers. Many of them are our community health centers. So they employ the apprentice, and then we manage the apprenticeship program for them. We teach the didactic education. They provide the on-the-skills job training, but we monitor it and we track their progress for all the apprentices. So all they have to worry about is employing that apprentice and providing them with mentorship. And we have registered apprenticeships for a variety of different, mostly entry-level healthcare fields. And then we have recently added a human services apprenticeship for direct support professionals. And those are individuals that work with people that experience a disability. And we're planning to launch a pharmacy tech apprenticeship in the fall. About a quarter of our apprentices are youth, and youth ages 8. We define that as youth being ages 18 to 24. Teens younger than 18 really can't work in our industry. We're actively working with Alaska Youth, Alaska Works Partnership on a youth apprenticeship grant. We're trying to increase the availability of apprenticeships for youth. We're also working with several school districts to connect their programs, their CTE programs, with our apprenticeship programs. So there is a lot of energy right now in creating apprenticeship opportunities for youth, and I really think that this bill would fuel that fire that's already starting to burn. We really believe in this apprenticeship model. It's an excellent model. It works really well for these entry-level healthcare jobs. I think one of the reasons is that because in many cases, facilities are already having to mentor and train staff. The recruitment pool out there for entry-level jobs is what it is. So, you know, out of necessity, you have to often hire someone who comes in and doesn't have that experience, and you have to train them up yourself. And so this apprenticeship model, you know, we can come in and provide that missing piece, which is that formal education in a structured way for that young person to learn the skills that they need to learn and have multiple mentors through that process, because we're a mentor for that apprenticeship, and then the site has a mentor for that apprentice. And these are really great jobs for people, especially for youth, especially for those that are coming in and they have no experience. They're able to get started. They're able to get a certification, get on a genuine career track without incurring any debt. And I had testified previously that we have a partnership with Alaska Pacific University, so our apprentices can earn college credit throughout their apprenticeship. I think having this bill structured so that they can earn dual credit is another wonderful thing. Our apprentices earn an undergraduate certificate through APU, and at the completion of their apprenticeship, that certificate, undergraduate certificate, can pull through to an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree, and that apprentice can get on a career ladder and go into nursing or public health or even business or social work, depending on what they're interested in. And not only that, but obviously they're earning that national certification through the Federal Office of Apprenticeship. I think many of our programs are really well suited for youth, especially those youth that are on that career track versus a college track. And I'm thinking of the DSP apprenticeship would be wonderful for a young person, as you know, our other ones as well. These apprenticeships give youth a well-lit path right out of high school. I think that's really important and difficult for some youth to get on the right path, and this provides it, and they can earn college credits at the same time if they choose.
Ms. Sell?
I just want...
Are you just about... You have about one more minute.
Okay. Let me just talk about the challenges, which is that it is really hard to convince employers often to take those leap of faith and go into apprenticeships. And I think this bill that provides the financial incentive to employers will really go a long way to offset the risk that they're taking. And the feedback I would provide is that, as Representative Fields mentioned, to offer this to the nonprofit sector. 90% of the employers that participate in our apprenticeships are nonprofits, and so this would really, really go a long way and really help the program. We would love to see this bill work for our nonprofits. So with that, I thank you very much for the opportunity to address you, and I really do look forward to the opportunities this bill will provide to youth in Alaska.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, could you reiterate or expand a little bit more? You're talking about the risks that businesses are taking for apprenticeships.
Yes. So in healthcare tends to be an environment where there's high-stakes safety and regulatory requirements. And, you know, in this environment, healthcare facilities aren't necessarily just keen to jump into a new training model. And even though apprenticeship is not new, it's new to our employers, our healthcare and human services employers in Alaska. It is new. And so there is that risk for them to invest the time and energy into trying this and time and energy and taking on new and inexperienced staff. And so I think an incentive would really be helpful.
Answer your question?
Follow on.
Follow?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, so the risks you were talking about were mainly the time and effort that these businesses are going to be putting into the apprenticeship program, mm-hmm. not necessarily risk to some of the patients or some of the administrative tasks that would be going on during this?
That's absolutely correct. You are absolutely correct. Yeah, I was not talking about risk to patients at all. I was just talking about the investment in time, for example.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? All right, Representative McCarty, and I'm just keeping a very tight eye on the time because
we're gonna
run long tonight, everybody. My apologies.
So, Maury, to the chair, Marcel, you said your apprenticeship program, you have to be 18 or older to be in the program. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Follow up with that is that you're constantly making mention of youth. I would call that young adults. And youth would be something that we generally categorize as teenagers that are. So what is your definition of youth in that aspect there? So we're understanding that.
So we have typically used the definition of youth as we have various programs such as we work with the WIOA program, which defines youth as individuals who are between the ages of 14 and 24. And so that's sort of the framework that we've been using. And so our youth apprenticeship program, for example, our youth apprenticeship efforts focus on individuals who are 18 to 24, and we do call them youth.
Okay, one last piece there.
Okay.
I usually experience youth that when they turn 18, they want to be a big girl, big boy, and no longer want to be called a youth.
Yes, we all know our prefrontal cortexes don't finish growing until we're 25, though, do they, Representative McCarty? All right.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today, Ms. Sell. It was very interesting. All right, next up we've got Kyle Kaiser with the Veterans Electrical Entry Program. Mr. Kaiser, are you online?
Hello, ma'am.
All right, introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, and we are a little tight on time, so if you can be disciplined.
I'll be as fast as I can.
Thank you.
My name is Kyle Kaiser. I am the membership development lead for IBW 1547, the state of Alaska. I'm also the president and founder of VIPER, a nonprofit that aids veterans and military spouses getting into careers. First off, I'd like to say thank you to everybody for addressing all of the topics talked about here tonight. It's been quite eye-opening with the different programs being talked about. I think one thing that we miss when we talk about apprenticeships is the tie-in to our military. I've heard youth, young adults, however you want to split that hair. I haven't heard the mention of military in a state where a good chunk of our population are military or prior service. Were related to in some way, shape, or form. There's not a lot of discussion on how apprenticeships affect our veterans. We have 200,000 veterans on average getting out of the military every year. 150,000 of them are unemployed and have no career path set up when they get out. The mission that I started with our nonprofit here in Alaska, VIPER, is to help bridge that gap between the military and civilian employment. And apprenticeships are an excellent way of doing that. Ann Velarde's on the call. Ann knows me from, well, when I first got out and was brand new into an apprenticeship up through my current roles now. An apprenticeship offers hope. When someone transitions out of the military, you don't have a whole lot of transferable skills. And it really is regardless of whatever military occupation you had in the service. You could have been, like myself, an airborne infantry sniper that you really don't have much to translate to, or somebody in the medical field, and their certs and skills won't necessarily transfer either. So when you have an apprenticeship, it fixes a lot of those issues because you're going to learn everything you need to know for your next career. I would like to definitely emphasize my support for expanding our efforts to bring people into apprenticeships. I do agree that the incentivizing is great. I would like to see the state that while they're offering these incentives also ensure that they inform employers that when they hire vets, there are federal incentives for that, something that doesn't get done a whole lot or isn't very well known or talked about. But what we're talking about with apprenticeships and how it relates to veterans is it's much more than just a job. You very well could be saving someone's life, giving them hope in their next career and a direction to move forward in. That's invaluable when the demons start calling out of the closet. While I think these will be great things for my children as they grow up, I still want to make sure that we look back for our brothers and sisters coming out of the military and looking to get into their next careers, and how apprenticeships can really be the answer to do that. And I know we've heard apprenticeships, pre-apprenticeships, internships, and there are different definitions. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter what program they're going through. It needs to have that kind of progression into that career. Like the Viper Aviation Maintenance Program we're launching in May. 12 weeks, we're going to run you through general aviation, and when you get out, you got two options. You can go through a school, a 147 accredited school, according to FAA regs, and get your AMP certificate that way, or you can go Part 65 and go to work at an employer. And most of them have their own internal apprenticeships in the company, not necessarily a broad-based apprenticeship like you see with building and construction trades, but an individual one inside the company. I think that this bill will help get more programs like that going with employers and open more opportunities up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. It was really interesting. All right. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Kaiser, it's great to hear from you, and I'm glad the Viper program is doing so well. If anyone here has a chance to, please contact Mr. Kaiser. It's a very in-depth conversation and great for these transitioning military members. Outside of that point, you did talk a little bit about federal incentives for apprenticeship. Is that just for military individuals, or what's the scope of that, if you know?
Through the chair, I was referring to the federal tax incentives for the employment of veterans. So if they're going to go tell somebody they're going to get an incentive from the state for creating an apprenticeship program, also informing them that if they bring and employ veterans through that apprenticeship, they can also get federal tax incentives for doing that.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Mr. Kaiser.
Thank you very much. That was very helpful. All right, thanks for your testimony tonight, Mr. Kaiser. Next up, we've got Jeff Libby. You on the line?
Hi, good evening, everyone.
All right.
For the record, my name is Jeff Libby. I'm the director for the Center for Strategic Partnerships and Research and the director for the Applied Environmental Research Center with the University of Alaska Anchorage. I previously served as the associate dean for the Community and Technical College at UAA. And I'd like to thank Co-Chair Sponholz and Co-Chair Fields for inviting my testimony on behalf of HB 132 to promote apprenticeship opportunities in the state of Alaska. And I'm here today to tell you about the work the University of Alaska Anchorage has been doing to support this national initiative for workforce development and helping to put Alaskans back to work, especially after the pandemic. First, I'd like to mention that the University of Alaska Anchorage and the University of Alaska Fairbanks both have associate degree programs that provide avenues for anyone who completed a registered apprenticeship to transfer related technical instruction from their apprenticeship into college credit within the University of Alaska system. So for example, an individual who completes an 8,000-hour apprenticeship can transfer their completed apprenticeship training hours and have that qualify for up to 38 university or college credits in the Apprenticeship Technologies Associate of Applied Science degree at either UAA or UAS. The remaining credits to complete these associate degrees can be completed 100% through distance delivery classes. The best part of this is that these degrees are part of what has been traditionally known as a 2+2 degree program, which means that all of these previously awarded college credits and training hours for their apprenticeship can be transferred into a bachelor's degree in applied leadership at the University of Alaska Anchorage. This degree can also be completed 100% online, which allows an avenue for anyone in Alaska that has completed a registered apprenticeship an opportunity to complete an associate's degree and a bachelor's degree, regardless of where they live in the state. To give you a brief history that was already mentioned by Representative Fields, this originally started with UAA's Community and Technical College that partnered with a local auto group in Anchorage to develop the first apprenticeship for automotive service and repair technicians. We anticipated existing students in our automotive technology program to enroll in this opportunity, which they did, but what we did not expect was employees from the organization enrolling in UAA's program because of the opportunity it provided for their career growth. As word spread through the program's advisory board, several other new car dealerships and independent service and repair facilities throughout Alaska wanted to be a part of this apprenticeship opportunity. So UAA applied to be a sponsor for multi-occupational apprenticeships with the U.S. Department of Labor. This sponsorship allows UAA to send students to any employer, and the university system provides the related technical instruction for the employer, and it can be in any occupation.
That's cool.
Since the establishment of UAA becoming a sponsor for multi-occupational apprenticeship, UAA decided to transfer that sponsorship from the Community and Technical College to the Center for Strategic Partnerships and Research, which lies under the Business Enterprise Institute. What this allows for is expansion across the colleges and the entire University of Alaska system to identify other opportunities for apprenticeship to help fill our workforce gaps. UAA has been collaborating with the American Association for Community Colleges and was awarded external funding to support apprentices in Alaska and increase these opportunities. Today, UAA is working with the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development in this national initiative for expanding community college apprenticeships that's sponsored by the U.S. Department of Labor and the American Association for Community Colleges. At this time, more than 300 universities and colleges are currently participating in this initiative. I think the term apprenticeship is not well defined, as it's already been mentioned in here when we try to define internships and what that looks like. And we often associate this with traditional skilled and technical trades when the term apprenticeship is used. But today, almost half of the nation's apprentices are working in the healthcare industry. Today, UAA has partnered with the Alaska Primary Care Associates and is working with UAA's College of Health to continue to expand this initiative and help put Alaskans to work. We also developed an apprenticeship program for diesel mechanics, and some of the related technical instruction is offered as articulated credit and dual enrollment for high school students throughout the state to help jumpstart careers. Lastly, UAA is currently developing a new apprenticeship in research for both graduate and undergraduate students to work in fields related to climate change, fisheries research, and other wildlife and environmental fields. This will be the first of its kind, and several universities in the lower 48 are interested in modeling the platform being designed by UAA. This will help UAA students, University of Alaska students across the board, gain field experience and hands-on research activities. I thank you for your time today, your support of the university system, apprenticeships, and listening to my testimony. Thank you again.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today, Mr. Libby. Are there any questions for the testifier? All right, Representative McCarty.
Yeah. Through the chair, Mr. Libby, are there your program, do you have kids in the middle college that are doing your program at UAA?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, at this point, we have a couple of initiatives underway. One of them is IT, which I know was mentioned several times today. The big thing that I think the university system offers is dual enrollment opportunities for high school students. At this point, we don't have anything with the middle college opportunities. That's kind of been an initiative for a while, but students that want to participate in apprenticeship, as an example, could get articulated credit or dual enrollment credits at the high school level and then transfer in this to expedite their careers in Alaska's economy.
All right.
Just a quick
one
follow-up.
More, a quick follow-up.
When you say dual enrollment, you're referring to high school credit plus college credit. Is that correct?
If they're taking a course that has articulated credit or is qualified as dual enrollment, they would be getting college credit at the high school level. So, for example, our automotive program, our diesel program, as well as the computer networking and systems technology program was mentioned, we all have articulated or dual enrollment courses offered at the high school level through those programs and several others. So students are gaining college credit while they're at the high school level.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Kaufman, last question.
Thank you. Through the chair and to this is, I guess, more a comment. I think most of us probably agree that apprenticeship programs and technical, vocational technical training is good. What I'm curious about with this is what will it cost? As I look through the bill, it seems like there's requirements for schools, there's other requirements. And I see a zero fiscal note. And so I would like to see more about that as we discuss this. That's a big question for me. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We will. Representative Fields, do you have a response?
I couldn't sure, tell I can, if that was. I can talk to that, and I think. Can you hear me now?
We sure can.
Okay. So, to Representative Kaufman, the Department of Labor has a strong network of apprenticeship specialists. The bill language directs the Department of Education to collaborate with them, and I would defer to Commissioner Johnson on explaining how he would envision implementing that. Obviously, it might change commissioner to commissioner, but I think that the resources we would actually be taking advantage of would be federal resources. And it reminds me of when I worked at the Department of Labor and applied for federal grants, and in partnership with a lot of really great people, we were lucky enough to receive them and help jumpstart programs like APCA. So we sort of positioned ourselves to benefit from federal funds. And I think the opportunity today is to build on past achievements. And in talking about the state's history on apprenticeship, a lot of this foundational work really goes back to when Click Bishop was labor commissioner and Governor Palin was governor. So, you know, when I was at the department, I felt like we were building on what they did then. The investment and support for apprenticeship has continued under this administration. And this bill really looks at what's next, which is these linkages with schools and the connections to college credit. There is more federal money coming down the line. And if we collaborate with State Department of Education, if we continue collaborating with the university, we're going to be very well positioned to capitalize on that. I think one of the things that I would really like to see federal dollars support, and this is something that I heard from CTE coordinators at the district level, is that the districts need people going out, making connections with employers so there are more school to apprenticeship programs, both for existing apprenticeship program sponsors and for employers who are looking for workforce but don't yet have an apprenticeship program. And, you know, paying those folks would absolutely take money, but that would be a role that federal money could play. I hope that answers your question, Mr. Kaufman. But in closing, Department of Labor at the state level already has good infrastructure. Department of Labor at the federal level already has good infrastructure. Here we're, I think, increasing coordination with State Department of Education to position ourselves to capitalize on federal grants.
Perhaps we can take this up a little bit further when we hear the bill again later this week. All right. Thank you very much. That was the last question, Mr. McCarty, Representative McCarty. Is it urgent?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
So the original question that Representative Fields asked is whether 108 is to stay part of this bill. And 75 to 80% of House Bill 108 is in this bill. I heard from various people here testifying, and really the testimony primarily was for people older than 18, and House Bill 108 is for high school students to be recognized to get into the trades and be recognized that they have certifications and all stuff to make them employable right away, if not more viable to the workforce within a short period of time. So my recommendation or desire is that remove all the language of House Bill 108 from House Bill 132.
All right. Thank you for that. And I think that part of that is because most of the testifiers we were hearing from today were talking about existing programs. So I think that that's a fair point. We didn't hear very much about high school level apprenticeship or pre-apprenticeship today in a lot of detail. Maybe we can revisit that as well when we talk about it at the next committee. And I know that Representative Fields will follow up with you on this as well. But it's now 8:45, and I want to make sure that we can move on. We're not going to take action on this bill today, so we're getting the issue out on the – getting your issues and concerns out on the record are important. I don't want to diminish those. We'll take them up. I just want to make sure that we can make sure to take up Representative Josephson's bill since he and his staff have been waiting here as well tonight. So your concerns are noted, and we will take them up in greater detail. All right. And with that, we're going to move on to HB 45. It's 8:45 at night, and I want to make sure we're sort of moving along with utmost haste at this point in time. So Representative Josephson is here along with Elise Soren-Burke, his aide. Online and available for questions are Scott Jordan with the Division of Risk Management, Marie Marks from Legal, Charles Collins with the Division of Workers' Compensation. All right, Representative Josephson, you want to give us the refresher? And I think you had a memo in response to some of our questions at an earlier committee.
Yes, Andy Josephson, House District 17, middle of Anchorage, more or less, for this bill. And with me is Elise Orenberg, my staff. The refresher would be that the origins of this bill stem from the COVID crisis, and an amendment, it was amendment number 5 to House Bill 241, which was in effect until November, the bill was in effect longer than that, but the provision that we're speaking of here was in effect until November 15th, and it offered, some might say, generous incentives to first responders to report to work as they normally would, and that only in times of a disaster declaration there would be a strong presumption that if they came down with the disease, in this case SARS-CoV-19, that it would be covered by workers' comp. And so that's the origin of the bill. The bill is in some respects less generous than the amendment I just spoke of, in that it does allow for a rebuttable position to be taken by the employer upon clear and convincing evidence that the employee did not, in fact, contract the disease at work. But still there's the presumption of compensability. It expands the class of workers principally in the area of grocery store employees and teachers and child care facilities. And I will turn to Ms. Sorenberg with your permission and see if there's anything I've missed.
Chair Sponholz, members of the committee, for the record, Elise Sorenberg, staff to Representative Josephson. I believe Ms. Holland passed out a memo answering some questions the committee members posed in a previous hearing. So we're open to taking any more questions members of the committee might have. But I
Does
think
everybody have the memo?
Summarized it well.
All right.
I'm looking for it.
It's on my letterhead and looks like this.
Okay. I'll make sure you've got it.
Oh.
There we go.
Thank you.
All right, you want to briefly walk us through the memo? Since most of us received it while we've been in committee tonight.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
So I'll just walk everyone through the memo again, Elise Sorenberg, for the record. The initial question posed last committee meeting was about the definition of grocery store. We touched on that, that is the only statutory definition of grocery store in Alaska statute. A new, more inclusive definition could, of course, be drafted by legal if the committee saw fit. And I think Representative Snyder might have something that addresses that to bring up. Representative McCarty questioned about whether an emergency could be statewide or regional or local in nature. And the answer to that is it can be any of those. Under AS 26.23.02C, which is that section of the Disaster Act where it outlines how a governor goes about declaring a disaster emergency, it just notes that the governor has to, quote, indicate the area, the threatened or affected area. There is, and I don't think I'm going to read this whole part, but it was asked that we supply the statutory definitions of disaster and that section for how the governor is able to declare disaster emergencies. It's worth noting that there's separate sections in the Disaster Act. The one that's referenced in our bill is the governor's power to declare a disaster emergency. And then there's a definitions section. And under that definitions section, there are several different definitions of disaster. One of them in subsection E of 26.23.902 is an outbreak of disease or a credible threat of an imminent outbreak of disease mm-hmm. that the Commissioner of Health and Social Services or designee, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, this is a long memo.
It's a very long definition. And that's what it's really, it's a very long list of different things that can be considered disaster emergencies. Representative Kaufman questioned about if there, an employer might be opened up to liability and by having one of their employees receive COVID workers' compensation. Our answer to that, and in speaking with a few people, is that under Alaska statute, workers' compensation files and medical records are kept confidential. They're not considered public records. If, of course, something becomes an issue of litigation, mm-hmm. those records might be released and become more public. One that I'm not going to go into a long, it's a very long section here, answer to one of Rep. Kaufman's other very good questions, and it is, he expressed some concerns about if employers might discriminate against employees in high-risk categories. Mm-hmm. There's a really great publication we found from the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, that was originally published during the H1N1 pandemic of 2009 mm-hmm. that they've updated for COVID. And the short answer is no, but it's more complicated than that. Okay. If I believe you guys are on page 3, my version is sloppier than yours. So the last paragraph of that section is kind of interesting because if something raises to a certain level of threat, then the employer can ask for certain things to be revealed that weren't able to be revealed otherwise. So it's not a straight no, but I think that will do a better job answering that question than me. And then Rep. Kaufman also inquired as to shared costs to the business communities. I think the NCCI analysis that is in your packets would be the best thing to look at for this. They ran 3 different scenarios using some modeling. They used infection rates of 5%, 15%, and 25% in their models. Alaska's real rate was about 5.9% at the end of December. In their models, they also used a mortality rate of 0.5%. Alaska's mortality rate has been 0.4%. So our looking at that model, the 5% cost scenario is probably the most accurate for Alaska. There's different caveats, and of course, it's not a perfect fit and a model, but their estimate was $2 million for the 5%. For what the overall workers' compensation costs would be. And then implications about sick leave, paid sick leave, and how that might interact with the workers' compensation system was also brought up by Representative Kaufman. And I spoke with both Director Scott Jordan and emailed with Director Charles Collins. And they both explained to me that since workers' compensation is designed really to be an exclusive remedy, the first money out is payment for workers' compensation. The state does an interesting thing where, since workers' compensation is based on 80% of a worker's average weekly wage when someone is out, the state will do something where an employee uses they basically calculate out what that remaining 20% would be, so the employee is made whole. And then by using that 20% from their leave, it also allows them to stay current with benefits. So that's how the state does it. Other employers might do it slightly differently.
The memo is very thorough and useful and could be a model for others in the building, let me just tell you, in terms of following up with the detail and specificity. It's very useful. Thank you.
Thank you. And the last question was, Rep. McCarty asked for just more details on the data and the costs and number of claims in Alaska. And Director Collins followed up with some numbers via email, and he noted that as of, this would be as of the 12th, 2,483 COVID-related cases had been opened. 1,000, I am not going to read all of the numbers to you, but those are new data up to date as of the 12th.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I'm wondering on this bill, does it cover, say, like retroactively, so previous iterations, so back in December?
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, that's a slightly complicated question. There's two different effective dates. There is a retroactivity clause. So anyone who was previously covered by the amendment in 241 last spring, their coverage would be retroactive to November 15th. And so that would be your first responders and your medical professionals. When the initial emergency declaration expired, all of those workers lost this incentive. But for the new groups of employees, there's just an immediate effective date.
Okay. Follow on, Madam Chair. The one thing I did note, and you had it in your sponsor statement, was an employer could only rebut a claim by producing clear and convincing evidence that an employee's infection was not work-related. What, in your example, would be clear and convincing evidence? Like, would that be a Facebook post of them partying without a mask on, or what does that kind of look like?
You know, through the chair, Representative Nelson, I believe Marie Marks from Legal might be on the line still, and if she is, she would be the one to. Is she not? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's okay. But we can. Maybe would you like to talk to evidentiary standards a little bit?
I hate to put you on the spot.
No. We do have, just for everybody's information, we've got Scott Jordan with the Director of the Division of Risk Management and Charles Collins with the Division of Workers' Compensation, if you want to throw the question to one of those people.
What I would propose, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. is just to make a quick response of my own. And so through the chair, Representative Nelson, it could indeed be something like a Facebook post. If a claim got really expensive, you could see an employer may want to depose people. He may want to find out where the claimant could have contracted the disease other than at the place of employment. What has happened with the benefit in Anchorage so far is that, for example, paramedics who bring patients to hospital, they test the patient for COVID, and they're in fact tracing it in the majority of circumstances, according to the attorney I spoke with at the municipality of Anchorage, who's litigating some of the other ones. They're able to trace it to the patient, and then the assumption is made and the claim is paid that the paramedic delivering the patient to the hospital contracted it from the patient. There are other cases where the narrow language in SB 241, which we don't exactly mirror here, is being challenged. And so the lawyers are battling in other cases. But Mr. with your permission, Madam Co-Chair, mm-hmm. if Mr. Collins wants to offer any other part of that answer, he's welcome
Does
to
that satisfy
that.
Your
Yeah, just at a later date or a okay. later time. Or
all right.
Okay.
And then follow on.
Follow up?
If I may. Mm-hmm. I apologize. Through the chair, I'm also looking, so I'm glad you touched on that a little bit. So say, you know, back in Anchorage, Joe Schmo is working at Fred Meyer's, doesn't get infected but goes home, and someone there doesn't know that they had the infection and then spreads it. Would that be technically, without them knowing, would that fall under the workman's compensation on this bill?
Through the chair, on those facts, there's a chance that the employee that you've just described would receive benefits.
Okay.
But the benefits would be limited by the fact that, first of all, there has to be a declared disaster. Mm-hmm. And it can't be a disaster like we saw in Haines, obviously, with the sloughing hillside. It's about infectious disease. Typically, the extent of that disaster is going to be 30 days unless the legislature extends it. Mm-hmm. So we think that this benefit is important, but it's constrained. And typically, it will not be utilized because it simply won't be available on the facts before the parties.
Yeah, and I hate playing the what-if games. I mean, I honestly do, but it's also good to, you know, game plan and say, okay, does this actually count for someone that not necessarily infected at the store that they're at, the grocery store, but once they get home? And I'll pause just in case anyone else has any questions. I hate to take up all the time.
Well, actually, I wanted to let you know that we do have Charles Collins on right now if you want him to address your
sure.
question about clear and convincing evidence.
That would be perfect.
All right. Mr. Collins, you on the line?
I'm here.
All right. We can hear you. Can you put yourself on the record? And did you get Representative Nelson's question?
This is Charles Collins with the Alaska Workers' Compensation.
Mm-hmm.
And I did hear his question, and I will say that it is somewhat complicated, as Representative Josephson stated. Beyond that, the employer could, if they decided that there was a possibility that it was contracted outside of the course of normal business, they could controvert it and have a hearing before a hearing panel. So then the employee and the employer would bring their evidence before an industry, a labor, and a hearing officer panel members. And so it's a very complicated question that, you know, you have to convince three people in an adjudication setting, you know, the merits of your case, just as with every injury and in workers' compensation where you have a controversy come into play. Hope that helps.
It does. Would we be able to talk a little bit more offline just for some more background information on that?
Through the chair, I'm always available to assist in any way I can. So,
all right,
no problem.
Perfect. I'm going to pause that way. Someone else is going to have a question.
All right. Other questions? Representative Kaufman?
Thank you. Through the chair. I guess I'm still curious about how we can assign blame, so to speak, or responsibility. In the example earlier, where some EMT technicians are responding and there's a COVID positive patient, they've got all their protective equipment on and they're in a controlled circumstance, but it sounds like we would assume that they caught it at work when indeed they may have caught it out at the bars the night before. Is it safe to assume that if someone works in a situation at work where there's a corona positive person, that would be a good case to assume that that's where the people caught it from? Thank you.
Do you want to take the question, Representative Josephson?
Sure.
Or should we ask Mr. Collins?
No, I'll take a step. So through the chair, Representative Kaufman. Right now under law, a person can, without this legislation, try to make a claim that they received or contracted an infectious disease under our current workers' comp statutes by exposure at the workplace. It's more, in other words, we're sort of living in that world right now anyway. It is more challenging than it would be under this bill because you have to prove that the conditions of your employment are such that they are substantially different from the background that we all live in, sort of the ambient background, mm-hmm. that you were susceptible to contracting the disease at that place of employment. But yes, You know, we saw, and Ms. Sorenberg presented some documents that are in your packet that show, and this is common knowledge at this point, that, for example, more police officers have died from COVID exposure than any other disease they've suffered from or being shot, et cetera. And certainly we know this is true in the medical community as well. So, and we know that PPE and other barriers and safety precautions may be insufficient. So, you know, part of this is a policy call that we want people to, without fear, go to work, put in 12-hour days to save our loved ones and do the work they need to do. And so we've tried to identify who are the essential workers and offer them this protection. Mr. Collins testified last week that only $850,000 has been spent, and that number is now slightly higher based on the data, just slightly, that Ms. Sorenberg gave you in this packet. It's eclipsed $1 million, but that's spread out over 730,000 Alaskans. Only 1 in 12 people, if I remember correctly, that have contracted COVID in Alaska are believed to have gotten it at work. And remember, that's 1 in 12. That would include a librarian who would not be an essential worker. So we're limiting the group from there. And again, the other thing to note, and Mr. Collins will tell you this, I'm sure, because he's told me, a lot of the people you see who filed claims simply went to get a COVID test. And they were told, like we are, hopefully, you're negative. And that is a workers' comp claim. So the numbers need to be sort of investigated and peeled back to really be understood. That's the best I can offer you.
All right, and we have several people that have been waiting to testify on this bill that I'd like to give the opportunity to testify since they've been waiting for quite some time, if that's all right. All right, we're going to go ahead and we're going to start with Jake Metcalf. Mr. Metcalf, are you online? All right,
can you hear me?
Oh, there we go. Mr. Metcalf, welcome. You've been online for a very long time, so thank you for your patience. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, co-chairs Sponholz and Fields. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I forgot members of the committee, too. My name is Jake Metcalf. I'm executive director of the Alaska State Employees Association, go by ASEA. We're part of ASME. We're Local 52. We represent approximately 8,000 hardworking public employees that deliver the critical services Alaskans rely on every day. Last year, essential workers, including our members, were asked to put themselves and their families at risk to keep Alaska running by ensuring critical services continued. Public employees are asked to rise above and go beyond to keep the lights on, keep our roads cleared, ensure our water is clean and safe, the children and families in need are cared for, and they look out for our most vulnerable populations with pride and dedication. This year was no different. The pandemic caught us all off guard. Organizations across the country realized that the pandemic preparedness was not in many people's rule books. The state of Alaska was no exception. All the while, as organizations and governments worked hard to respond to the novel coronavirus pandemic, our essential workers never stopped working. They couldn't because their work was and continues to be essential. The pandemic that we stumbled through revealed numerous gaps in the safety net we cast for Alaska's working people. This bill will help fill one of the holes in our safety net by providing a remedy for frontline workers and their families if they contract epidemic disease. Several of our members, and especially those that work in corrections and 24-hour facilities like the Pioneer Home and McLaughlin Youth Center, have personal stories they can share about their working conditions and exposure to the virus. We ask those dedicated Alaskans to take major risks to keep Alaska running. I ask that the legislature think about those workers and pass this important legislation so that those risks are met with some relief for the worker and their family. In conclusion, House Bill 45 is critical towards ensuring that we are taking care of the essential workers that are taking care of us. This bill is just one step that will fill a gap that became too wide and too consuming as essential workers fell ill with little to no relief. Families should not feel forced to choose between their health or safety and earning a living. While this bill can't protect dedicated essential employees against contracting the disease, it will offer them relief they will need if they do suffer from a pandemic illness. HB 45 is a way to ensure essential workers in Alaska are cared for as they are being asked to care for Alaskans. Please pass House Bill 45. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony tonight, Mr. Metcalf, and thank you also to the members of ASEA who worked in some pretty tough working conditions routinely, but especially this year. We know there were COVID outbreaks in several of our prisons, for example, and we know your members worked very hard to keep our elders safe in the Pioneer Home. So we're very appreciative, and I'm sure you'll extend our appreciation to your members. All right. And I failed to open public testimony, and I'm sure everybody will be a little gracious with me, so I'm opening public testimony right now. We're just going to reorder things there a little bit. That's what happens when you stay this late. All right, next up, we've got Charles Stewart on the line. Mr. Stewart?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Charles Stewart, and I am the chair for the ASEA AFSCME Local 52 Probation and parole officers and the Class 1 rep. Thank you for allowing me to speak to House Bill 45 tonight. I'm here to talk in support of this bill using my own personal experience on a contagious disease, COVID. I tested positive for COVID at the end of December. I was exposed to at work. I know this because I was so afraid of getting COVID, I only went to work and home every day. I did this because of my age and my health issues. My girlfriend works from home and did not leave our house at all for the same reasons. We ordered all of our food from Fred Meyer's and had it delivered to our home. We did not get out and go shopping. All peace officers, firefighters, EMTs, and paramedics experience hospital exposure to contagious diseases daily and these types of employment and working conditions. We never know what we're walking into daily. This bill would support us and give us some peace of mind that we would not have to worry about all of the other personal leave for medical reasons in case there is another health issue in the future. That's all, ma'am.
Oh, thank you very much for your testimony. Thanks for sharing your story with us, and I hope that you are healthy again. Are there any questions for Mr. Stewart? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony tonight. Next up, we've got Paul Miranda with the Alaska Professional Firefighters.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Miranda. I'm the president of the Alaska Professional Firefighters, and I'm an engineer paramedic with the Anchorage Fire Department at Station 14 in Northeast Anchorage. I'd like to first start by thanking the committee for your willingness to work on this important issue. It's an issue that's important to all the men and women in our state who serve our communities as first responders and frontline essential workers. As president of the Alaska Professional Firefighters, I'm here today to express our strong support for House Bill 45 on behalf of our over 500 professional firefighters and emergency medical personnel in the state of Alaska. Firefighters and EMS personnel place themselves in harm's way when caring for patients in uncontrolled environments, such as a patient's home or in the back of an ambulance. We're not afforded the opportunity to work in a controlled environment with properly ventilated rooms and other protective measures that are not available in the pre-hospital environment. First responders, along with other frontline essential workers, are at much higher risk of exposure to contagious disease due to the nature of the work, and therefore are much more likely to contract certain illnesses through the course of their work than individuals in other career fields. As we saw at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, many of our departments in the state struggled to obtain adequate levels of PPE to sufficiently protect our first responders, which put them at further risk of exposure to the virus in this case. Due to the nature of emerging infectious disease outbreaks or pandemics, there are a lot of unknowns at the beginning until scientists and researchers have time to figure out the nature and characteristics of disease transmission. While it can be difficult to pinpoint exactly where an exposure to an illness came from, we know that our first responders and essential workers are out on the front lines, being potentially exposed each time they go to work. First responders take an oath to protect life, property, and the environment throughout our career. It's critical that our state's first responders and frontline essential workers know that we are protected and that the state will have our backs so that we can focus squarely on this oath we promise to keep. The Alaska Professional Firefighters strongly support House Bill 45 and urge the committee to support it as well. Thank you for my time.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony tonight, and thank you to all of your members for your work responding in tough conditions this year, taking on additional risk this year. All right, we have a question coming up here from Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Miranda. Appreciate your service. I'm curious, one of the things that's kind of challenging me in getting my mind wrapped around this, so the firefighters that you're referencing, they all have sick leave, as far as I know. Is that correct?
Through the co-chair, Representative Kaufman, yes, that's correct.
Follow up?
And so I guess what I'm wondering, if somebody's already covered by sick leave, what's the driving need for this? It seems like belt and suspenders. So that's what I'm wondering. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, I think the answer to your question there is the notion that if someone contracts a disease such as this through the course of their employment, that individual should not be burdened with using their own leave, their own sick leave, if they have it, and that should be covered by the employer if, in fact, they contracted the disease while in the course of their normal duties.
Follow up? Representative Kaufman?
Thank you. Through the chair. Yes, I guess, well, if you said that they wouldn't use their sick leave for that, but that's what it's for, or they might not want to use it for that. So I'm still not convinced that when someone is covered by sick leave, when I got sick, probably most of the time I caught it at work, you know, typical flu or cold season, all of that. So I'm just trying to understand it. Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, I may be able to add a couple features to this.
Go ahead.
First of all, this is a pandemic where the lucky ones are asymptomatic. Children, for example, may be asymptomatic. A lucky adult may be affected for 3, 4, 5 days, but others are on ventilators or they're at the hospital. But fundamentally, the three basic things that come to mind are that you wouldn't need to use your sick leave, which is what Mr. Miranda said. You would have full medical rather than being subject to deductibles and copays. You'd also receive a spendable weekly wage, so it doesn't often amount to much, but you would get something rather than no weekly wage. So those are just some of the features that come to mind. And if you're sick or you're a long hauler, and it's months and months, it's meaningful to have that rather than to have a sick leave bank that is expired, essentially.
Thank you. All right, Representative Nelson.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. And through the chair, going off of what Representative mm-hmm. Kaufman was saying, in relation to the previous statements, was saying that it's even difficult to pinpoint exactly where the infection came from. So how do we know if it didn't come at work or at another point in time? That's just where I have a little bit of a quandary with, and just hoping, just wanted to get that statement out there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, and maybe we could go back to I think you were going to have a conversation with Mr. Collins, but maybe Mr. Collins could talk about sort of the process for determining whether, in fact, there is employer responsibility again. I'm asking Mr. Collins to answer the question first.
Chair Sponholz, I'm so sorry. I was.
That is all right.
I was waiting for you. So, once again, as with any workplace injury, the employee at any time, occasionally we will see a report of injury that maybe did not happen at work. The employee has a responsibility of turning in his paperwork, and the employer always has the rebuttable evidence that they can bring forth whether it was. So a little bit, a disease might not be quite as straightforward as a slip and fall, but there certainly is a possibility that it could be rebutted. And so the employer could controvert the claim or deny the claim, and the employee would then be forced to go to a hearing to prove up their case, shall we say.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative McCarty.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Miranda, thank you very much for what you do. A long time ago, during the graduate work, I drove an ambulance in L.A., and that was during the start of the AIDS epidemic or disease type thing. And ironically, the ambulance company was named AIDS Ambulance. So a lot of people said, I don't want to get in there. But we were dealing with bloodborne pathogens and fluids. And what we're talking about here is airborne pathogens, which brings up the whole piece of, we have airborne pathogens all the time in our industry. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, that is correct.
Follow-up?
And for the follow-up is like, how does the industry now differentiate someone's illness from airborne pathogens that was acquired on the job or not?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, I think the nature of this pandemic has kind of opened our eyes to some of those things, and maybe so we have personal protective equipment. Mm-hmm. Things like N95 masks and PAPR devices now, which are respiratory protection, that we're now, at least in Anchorage and most of our departments, are wearing in every interaction with a patient. As far as differentiating previously, I think, it was a little bit more traceable to, it was a little easier to trace because we weren't in the middle of a global pandemic, if that makes sense. If you took someone to the hospital, they get diagnosed with a respiratory illness. The hospital follows up and, you can easily trace that exposure to the workplace, whereas COVID-19 is a little bit different. Does that answer your question, sir?
One more follow-up.
It answers the question. Also, that brings up the question of that if an employer is doing due diligence to make sure the workplace is safe, and you describe those characteristics of having the masks and having those different pieces, at what point does it become an infraction or a claim to the employer? And in your case, there. I guess that's a question, too, for the workplace.
Yeah, that might be a better question for Mr. Collins. Mr. Collins?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty. So That is that's an extremely good question, and there probably isn't a definitive answer, although I will remind the committee that the firefighters already have a presumption of coverage for certain diseases that was taken up half a dozen years ago or so. AS 2330-121 speaks directly to that, which was a little bit of a carve-out. So for certain carcinogenic airborne particles that may cause certain lung diseases, and it has a whole, it has a list of them there. They have a presumption which allows them greater access to workers' compensation than say somebody that you know, just worked as a construction worker but burned things all day long might get into the same type of material and would not be covered, because it's a much steeper incline for them to prove that it's actually a workplace injury. So by moving the needle of the presumption, we just open the gate a little bit wider to what is a workplace injury, whether it's an airborne disease or a blood-based pathogen or whatever it is. And I think that's a discussion for the committee to have. And if you want workers' comp's director's opinion on it, I think we need to be extremely careful about how wide open we open that floodgate. So,
all right, thank you. And Mr. Miranda, do you want to take a stab at that now?
Madam Chair, yes. If I could just maybe add to one of my previous responses a little bit, specifically to Representative Kaufman's question of me initially. I think Representative Josephson's answer was very accurate in speaking to the need for this, not necessarily for, you know, just for those folks who may have minor symptoms and be, you know, be sick and miss a couple of days of work, but we do have an individual who contracted COVID while at work, worked at a busy station. You know, it was well documented. This was towards the beginning of the pandemic that they responded to many COVID positive patients, and is having long-term significant symptoms from COVID. So I think that also kind of speaks to the need for this bill, specifically in these pandemic situations that can have long-lasting effects on employees. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that. And it's now 9:30. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony and mention. So we're not going to move the bill from committee tonight, but we do have one amendment. Representative Snyder.
Yes, I move amendment number one.
Is there an objection?
Object.
All right. You want to speak here?
Yes, thank you. So this amendment adds two things, employee of a farmer's market and employee of a vendor who sells at a farmer's market, using the existing definition for farmer's markets in the Alaska Administrative Code. Adding these occupations to the list originally covered in House Bill 45 on page 2, if you're looking there, is in line with the rationale for including grocery store workers, which is to ensure that we provide peace of mind to those Alaskans, those essential workers, making sure we have access to a basic resource, food, in the time of a pandemic. Farmers markets, they're increasingly an important venue for food procurement in Alaska. They were thrust into the pandemic response conversation just this past year when they weren't initially included in the list of operations permitted to be open during the temporary lockdown in Anchorage. After discussions with local leadership and with food-focused stakeholder groups, the importance of farmers markets to food access as well as to local economies, including our Alaskan farmers and food vendors, was recognized. And farmers markets were added to the list of the operations that should stay open. So this amendment simply seeks to make sure farmers market workers delivering the same important services as grocery store workers are protected.
All right, thank you. Is your objection maintained? All right. You want to speak to it?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Snyder. I mean, you and me both know the farmers market are extremely prevalent, and especially in East Anchorage. You know, we just heard from some of the previous speakers about how important it is to make sure, you know, people are covered for what they have to do and if they come in contact with COVID. And one gave a warning of not trying to cast this net out too wide. And I feel like having an employee of a farmer's market, an employee of a vendor who sells at a farmer's market is a little too wide for me. That'd be something I'm uncomfortable with just because of anyone's able to get out and either get a license or set up shop and start selling, and you don't know specifically if that person has COVID or what their prior experience was or who's going to be walking in and out and talking to that person. So I think that's just too broad for my taste. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other comments, Representative Kaufman?
Thank you. Yes, through the chair. I'm struggling with the scope of this, the potential impacts of all of it. So this amendment is kind of a nuance around a bigger picture that I'm greatly concerned about. For one thing, the bill allows who the bill applies to be defined in the future by a commissioner. So there's no real scope of applicability, as I understand it. That can be defined to mean other groups. So I'm not sure, getting this in the bill would be one thing, but it wouldn't solve the concerns of the greater potential in the future of how this could be defined outward. Thank you.
I'm sorry, are you suggesting that this amendment dramatically expands the applicability in the bill?
No,
I'm not reading it that way.
I'm saying not this, so to speak, but this doesn't address that concern.
Okay, so you have concerns with the underlying bill, not necessarily with the amendment, but you're not going to support the amendment either.
This doesn't.
That's fine.
This doesn't go far enough in that respect.
All right, fair enough. Did you want to respond?
Sure, just briefly. And I appreciate there are still some questions and further discussions around HB 45. I would just try and emphasize and highlight here that short of us approving or voting to support HB 45, simply this amendment looks at the groups covered, the occupations covered. And I think it's a pretty easy connection that if we're interested in protecting essential workers that are ensuring that we have access to food resources in the time of a pandemic during a disaster declaration, that they are just as important as our grocery store workers.
I'll just add to this. I think one thing that's sort of unique about farmers markets and those that sell produce at our markets are that they can only operate during a very limited time frame. And we're actually trying to, support our farmers and ensure that our farmers can, have a market for their produce and that folks of our state have access to fresh produce, which we haven't always had. I remember the bad old days when we didn't have a lot of fresh produce and we couldn't get any Alaska produce. And so our farmers markets have come a long way. And if this is the kind of thing that can help keep our farmers markets open and keep people working during that time frame, I think that seems like a positive thing to me. All right. Do you feel strongly about this? Last bite at the apple, man, and then we're going to vote because it's 9:35, really,
I just want to say I love our farmers markets. I do. But the other thing is they are outdoors, so inherently there's a bit lower risk issue there for many of them, not all.
Yeah. Representative Snyder.
So sorry, but just point of clarification. Some, but not all, and of course some are in pavilions that are somewhat enclosed, partially enclosed, fully enclosed, so being cognizant of the different conditions. Thank you.
All right, so our objection is maintained, so we're going to go ahead and call the roll. Clerk, can you call the roll?
Representative Schrage?
Yay. Yes.
Representative Snyder?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Kaufman?
No.
Representative McCarty?
No.
Co-chair Fields?
Yes.
Co-chair Swanholz?
Yes.
Four yeas, three nays.
All right, seeing that, Amendment 1 passes, and we will take up the bill for final action on Wednesday. We've been informed that we can't take a formal action while Representative Fields is not present, so we have to hold it over for that. It wasn't for any other reason than just to make sure he's in the building. All right, this is last item of business today is forwarding the appointees we heard in our last meeting for consideration in a joint session. So the House Labor and Commerce Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointees as shown and recommends the names be forwarded to the joint session for consideration. The names that will be shown are Bronson Fry and Christina Gilbert for the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board and Brian Larson, the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. This does not reflect any intent on the part of the members to vote for or against this individual during a joint session for the purpose of confirmation. This wraps up our business today. Thanks, everybody, for staying late. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, March 17th at 5:45. It will not go to 9:35 p.m. I appreciate everyone's flexibility on working the late meetings. On Wednesday, as we work through the budget process, we're trying to get caught up for lost time here. So on Wednesday, we're going to take action on HB 45 and that we heard tonight in HB 100 as well, hold introductory hearings for HB 133 and HB 121 relating to child care tax credits. Amendments for the TVEP bill, that's HB 100, are due tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. Our intent is to move the bill on Wednesday given the time sensitivity and the program's importance to workforce development. And I'll ask the committee members to sign this report before you leave. This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is now adjourned at 9:38 p.m.